The text that we'll stand beneath this morning will be from 1 Samuel chapter 4, if you want to turn there. I want to talk on this great day of hope about two kinds of hope that we often have. Hope in something temporary, versus the opportunity to hope in someone eternal. Now, when you're hoping for something temporal, you're hoping for a particular short-term outcome, for maybe some particular circumstance to go your way, some way that you want it to. How many of you ever said, I hope I get that job, right? Hope I get that house. I hope I get that girl. I hope I get that girl that gets that job so we can get that house, if you're really smart. Because we know that every temporal thing that we hope for eventually is going to disappoint us. Every circumstance, every situation that we hope for is going to wear out sometime. It's going to give out. It's going to fall apart. It's going to melt down. It's going to go away. And when that happens, the question is, where is your deeper hope? Where is your foundational hope? The hope that's there when all other hopes are gone. When you've lost something that you were hoping for, and it might have been a really, really big something, do you have someone that you can put your hope in that will always be there, no matter what? So I want to start with this obscure story in the Old Testament. But make no mistakes, this is an Easter story. It's early on in the history of Israel. It's after 40 years, they've been wandering in the wilderness after the Exodus. They've been carrying the Ark of the Covenant with them in the tabernacle. God's been with them. They finally get to the Promised Land, but they're struggling. They don't have a king. This is before the time of David and Solomon. They're not in the picture yet. But things are looking very, very dismal in 1 Samuel. We learn right away that the leaders are ineffective. The house of Eli, its leadership has failed. Eli's two sons, the priests, are both self-indulgent. And they're involved in blatant sexual misconduct in their leadership, even their service at the temple. And God pronounces judgment upon this family in 1 Samuel 2:12. And then we read also that not only is the leadership, the religious and political leadership in the country failing, but they're at war with their arch rival enemies, the Philistines. And they go to this first battle with the Philistines in Samuel, and it's terrible. There are 4,000 soldiers that are killed. And the people are asking, what is going on with us? Where is God? Why didn't He give us what we were hoping for? What's happening here? And as they're having this meeting, this communal lament, as always happens, somebody gets an idea. The light bulb goes off in their heads. And they say, let's try this battle again. Only let this time, let's make sure that we bring the Ark of the Lord with us. We'll bring our secret weapon. And if we bring the Ark of the Lord with us, there's no way we'll be defeated. Now, for those of you that don't know, the Ark of the Covenant was this box. Inside this box, they kept some of the manna that God had given them, fed them within the Exodus in the wilderness. They also kept the Ten Commandments, not the original, because Moses broke those, but the second copy, they kept those in the Ark of the Covenant. But it wasn't just a box that contained these relics. Also, it had a mercy seat on the top. And the people believed that this is where the presence of God was. That when the tabernacle was set up and the ark was there, that this is where the people could go and seek God and get mercy and forgiveness of their sins. And they're thinking, you know, this is kind of like our God in a box. Maybe they were thinking, we can bring Him into battle and there's no way that we could ever lose, because God would never be defeated. God could never be captured. And if we'll bring the ark into the battle this time, we will win for sure. He has to give us what we're hoping for. Now, there's a way to illustrate this kind of odd theology behind this way of thinking. It's from a show called The Simpsons. I didn't actually watch this episode or watch this show, but the elders told me about it. Anyway, there's one episode where Homer pledges money to this PBS telephone drive. And he is just tired of the drive. It's interrupting all the shows. He wants to get it over with. So Homer agrees to give a bunch of money, a ton of money, to this PBS telephone drive. The problem is Homer doesn't have the money. He just wants the drive to be over. Well, they find out about it. So they make Homer go serve with a bunch of missionaries on a tropical island after they find out what he's done. Well, the people that he's serving with build a new church. Now, Homer, if you've watched his show at all, is not a theologically astute character, but he's very proud of what they've been able to do together on this island. And he sums it up like this. He says, well, I don't know much about God, but we sure have built him a nice little cage. And that might be what the Israelites are thinking. They've got God in his box, so they go to battle a second time. They're exuberant. They're certain. They're full of joy. They've got the prayer warriors working on all sides. They're certain that this is God's will. And the Philistines hear about it. And they're just as certain that God has come to fight them. They are afraid. They are filled with fear. You see, the Philistines have read Israelite history. They read Moses' second book of Exodus. And they know that this is the God who has terrorized the Egyptians. And then it happens. God moves boldly into the field of battle. And what a wild battle scene it is. Strewn bodies, blood, frantic escaping soldiers, cries throughout the land. Only the winning team is not Israel. The Ark of God has now become a Philistine trophy. It's unthinkable. It's beyond imagination. When the report comes to Eli the priest, he first hears the news of the defeat. He knows defeat has happened before. He's aghast at it, but he hears the news and he accepts it. He's then told that his two sons have been killed in the battle. That's acceptable too, because they were evil men. God had foretold that they were going to be killed. But when he hears that the Ark of God has been captured, that God has capitulated, at this news, Eli falls off his wheelchair and breaks his neck and dies. And then the scene moves on to Eli's daughter-in-law's house, just become a widow and pregnant with their first child. And this news, as it pressed Eli into death, presses her into life, into birth. And they tell her, don't despair, have hope. But she refuses to listen. In her last dying gasp and breath, she names the boy she bears Ichabod. Now, Kabod is this main word in the story. Kabod is the main idea that's going on in all of 1 Samuel. And it's the Hebrew word for glory. But when you put a little "ih" in front of Kabod, it's like making it a negative. And what she's saying is, the glory is gone. There is no more glory. The whole thing is a pipe dream. Maybe Abraham was wrong and Moses was just wandering around in the wilderness and all these things were just kind of great circumstances. There is no God. There is no Yahweh. There is no glory. Life no longer means anything. You're born, you die, that's it. Our son might as well know that as soon as he's able to say his own name, Yahweh no longer reigns. The glory is gone. And perhaps if you were there that day, standing on the road between Ebenezer and Ashdod, you would have seen the Ark of the Covenant go by. Maybe you would have seen the God of the Exodus, invisible, hands on the prison wagon, gaping out at you as he goes in capture to Ashdod. The first day is a very dark day. It looks like the God of glory and of Israel is defeated. It looks like the glory is gone. Now, you know what day it is, don't you? Of course you do. It's Friday. It's the day of breaking old certitudes. It's a day of departure. It's a day of exile. It's a day of absence. It's a day of pain. And that day often comes close. There are many Fridays in our lives. It comes close right now in our society in mass shootings. It comes close in vanished children. It comes close in collapsing savings accounts. It comes close when dreams are lost. It comes close in the malignancy, in the paralyzed athlete, in the lost job, God has been captured. The glory departed. Ichabod. That's the first day. Beyond what anybody would have ever thought, beyond imagination, beyond prediction, heaven is silent. There is no hope. There is no glory. And no one can understand why. And it's when everything seems hopeless, when all of the things that we had been counting on are now diminished, that's when the story tends to get interesting. This first day, this triumphal procession, it rolls on into Ashdod. A procession that would make the sweet potato queens look like sourdoughs. And they proceed to the temple of Dagon. There you could imagine what a great religious ceremony they must have had in Ashdod that day. Prayers of thanksgiving, booty being divided, songs, revelries, shouts of praises. The prisoner is put on exhibit before their god Dagon. The ark, as it's brought into their temple, more shouts, more celebration. A long day, everybody's fatigued, finally the day is over. The parade ends, the benediction is given, the service concludes. The military leadership retreats to the officers' club for a few drinks. The priests do the sweep of the shrine, check the doors and the windows, gauge down the air conditioning, turn off the lights, set the alarm, and go home. In the shrine of Dagon, it is very quiet and very dark. Eeriness pervades as Dagon, upon his threshold, stands towering above the ark of Yahweh. No one did anything. No one said anything. And this is the second day. On the second day, the people return to the shrine. After all, this is the day when the trophies are dispersed to the winning team. This is the day of the ticker tape parade that will go and end at the shrine. And the priests awake a little bit late from all the partying the night before, but they quickly rush to prepare the shrine for the second day's activities. And the priests open the door to the shrine of Dagon, this great temple, and they look in, and before they can enter, pause. Bewilderment. Wonder. Dagon, you see, lies face down on the floor as if he's bowing before Yahweh. An accident, no doubt. That intern forgot to tighten the bolts at the base of the statue. Or better yet, one of those drunks that was at the party last night leaned a little bit too heavily. Or this could be the fourth in a series of teenage pranks that have been going on, break-ins over the last few weeks. So the priests hustle to get things back in order. They get Dagon back up on his threshold. They tighten down the bolts extra tight. They dust off his nose. And then everyone proceeds with the day's celebrations. And then comes evening of the second day. Shut down of the shrine. Quiet, darkness, stillness. One final check just to make sure everything is well sealed, everything's secure and in place, and then rest for all parties. There's the second day. This day is Saturday. It's a day of hidden combat. It's a day shrouded in mystery. It's a day of ambiguity and anxiety. And some days are just like that. But our story of Easter is a third day story. When a hero named Joseph was in prison, he said to Pharaoh's cupbearer, "In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your job." When Israel was trapped in slavery, you remember this, Moses asked Pharaoh, "Let us go into the wilderness for 3 days." When the Israelites arrive at Sinai, God says, "Consecrate the people and make them ready by the third day, because on that day I will come to my people." When Israel was threatened with genocide, this harem girl, Esther, says that she will fast for 3 days before going before the great king and asking for a people's deliverance. When Jonah is swallowed and is in the belly of a big fish, does anybody want to guess at how many days he got to ride in that big fish? You know that story. 3 days. When Israel was afraid to enter the promised land, God said to Israel, "Don't be afraid, don't be discouraged. 3 days from now, you will cross the Jordan into the land that the Lord wants you to possess." 3 days was used so frequently, and we had that reading from Hosea. It was used so frequently in this way that it became a technical expression in Israel, meaning a time to wait for deliverance. Don't give up hope. Right now, things are messed up. Right now, hope is being crushed. Right now, hearts are disappointed. But 3 days, a better day is coming. 3 days anticipates what God can do and nobody else can do. What God can do that we can't do for ourselves. When God will move from Ichabod to Kabod. So let's go back to Ashdod. Morning breaks on the third day. The priests get an early start. They open the doors again. Pause. Bewilderment. Absolute shock. It's Saturday all over again, but there is more on Sunday. Dagon's head lies on the floor, separated from his body. He's been decapitated in the middle of the night. This Dagon, who has tried to wrestle sovereignty from Yahweh, has literally lost his head in the process. Not only that, but even more. Like Venus de Milo, his arms and hands are cut off, spread out on the floor, helpless, impotent, weakened, defeated. And now the Philistines throughout the city soon begin to bear the heavy weight of the glory of Yahweh. He is up and on the move. It is they, not the Lord, who have now become the prisoners in their own city. Finally, having had enough of this, the Philistines put the Ark of God on a cart, being pulled by two mama cows whose babies are kept up in a barn back home. And with the cows crying the whole way, God pushes him back up towards his people. On the third day, the story takes a 180-degree turn. The idol is overturned. The time of captivity is over. God is going home to his people because the third day is God's day. That is the day of hope. He is a third-day God. And one day, after this, deliverance would come in a way that nobody was looking for. God would come back to his people, not in a box, but in a man. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. That word dwelt there is the word tabernacled. The Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. That tabernacle was a place where the Ark of the Covenant was. And the Word became flesh, tabernacled among us, and we beheld his kabod. We beheld the glory of the one and only who came from the Father. But it was a funny kind of glory. It came in the strange combination of humility and loneliness and fearlessness. Nobody could tame Jesus. Not the politicians, not the zealots, not the religious leaders. And nobody could use him for their own ends. Nobody could manipulate him to get him to do what they wanted. Nobody could convince him to be quiet. So in the end, those who thought they had the power, they took him. And they bound him, and they mocked him, and they hung him on a cross, and he gasped his last breath, and he said, "Ichabod, why am I forsaken?" And they pierced him with a sword, and they laid him in a tomb. And that was the first day, and it was a dark day. And his followers were absolutely crushed. They had seen the glory for a while, and now it was gone. And the second day didn't look a whole lot better. On the second day, Pontius Pilate posted a guard just to make sure nothing would happen. On the second day, Pilate sealed the tomb. He wanted to make sure that nobody came in and did any funny tricks. He posted a guard and he said to himself, "That will be the end of that. No more hearing from this Jesus. We have built him a nice little cage forever." But you see, Jesus never was a cage kind of guy. They didn't know it, but death was not defeat for him. And the Lord himself determined to do what you and I could not do, could never do. Not with all of our little efforts of self-improvement. Trying to do better. Trying to give enough. Trying to go to church enough. trying to serve enough, do enough nice things, things we could never do for ourselves. Jesus was setting everything right between God and us. Jesus was making His own way despite us so that He could come home to His people. That was the second day. That's what was going on the second day. It was a dark day. It was a disappointing day. But Jesus is a three-day God. The third day is God's day. The day when the prisoners of Pharaoh get set free. The day when people come to the mountains before the Lord and they shake and rivers are parted and people go into the promised land. The third day is the day when Esther faces down the powerful giant king. The third day is the day that prophets like Jonah are dropped off on the seashore. When idols like Dagon come tumbling down and God starts coming home to His people. The third day is the day that stones are rolled away and the tomb is found empty. The day a crucified carpenter comes back to life. You never know what a third day God is going to do in somebody's life. Because He is the God of the third day. And it's a matter of historical record. You are here today because there was once a time when this frightened band of foolish, scattered followers came in contact with this third day risen God. And they would go on in their lives and talk about this third day God without fear. They would put their own lives, their own possessions, their own families at risk. They would be pierced with swords. They would be crucified themselves. Their property would be taken. And they would give up their lives. And if it were not true, if they did not definitely know about a third day God, if anybody could have pointed to a pile of bones that was the body of Jesus, they never would have done that. Because nobody is going to die for a pile of bones. But they will die for a third day God because they know what lies beyond Friday and Saturday. And among these followers, they made the first day the Lord's day. Because they were a third day people now. And they were going to bet the whole farm on this third day. So my question about Easter is, how about you this morning? I don't know what you're hoping for. Maybe what you're hoping for is a wonderful and good thing. Maybe it's something for your health or for healing. Or maybe it was something good that hasn't happened. The question is, what are you putting your ultimate hope in? Your foundational hope. What is there worth building a life on? A lot of people are putting their ultimate hope in something, some circumstance, some outcome, some situation. Maybe it's a marriage. Maybe it's a job. Maybe it's their health. Maybe it's money. Maybe it's security. Maybe it's affection. It's going to let us down. Sometimes the topic of my demise comes up in our house. It's not always from Linda Sue. Linda and Cody were in Senatobia last weekend, and this thing called Mama Cat had babies. And all these little baby things were there with their eyes closed. And Cody came home and he said, "Dad, we're going to get one of those baby cats and bring it home." I said, "No, Cody, we're not going to do that. I don't like cats and we're not going to get a cat. We've already got a dog. We certainly don't want a cat." And Cody said, "Well, we'll just get one after you're gone." One day I was telling him about life insurance. I thought, you know, well, this is a chance to kind of explain to my son how I'm planning for their future, how, you know, how much I've done for them, how concerned I am for the family, and, you know, life insurance involves, you know, the possibility of your own death, and this will be a way for him to be concerned and give me a little affection. I know it sounds silly, but, you know. So it's kind of a foolish thing on my part. After all, the kid likes cats. But I said, "Cody, I've taken out this life insurance policy." He was asking about this. He'd heard us talking about it. He said, "That's to take care of my family. That's in case Dad dies. Because they have this policy, you guys will be okay. Because I have this policy, you'll get hundreds of thousands of dollars." And you could tell he was really taken back because I was talking about my death. And with wide eyes, he said, "A piece?" What I'm trying to say is if you're putting your hope in somebody that you're going to wheedle some affection out of, or in a pile of money that's going to come your way someday, or in a scheme that's going to out-scheme aging or death, if you're putting your hope in anything, any circumstance, It will disappoint you in the end. So Jesus' followers that saw him on the third day would say, put your ultimate hope in Jesus. Put your life and your eternal destiny in his hands. And when you do that, you put your hope in the one place on earth you know it can never be disappointed. And will always be present. No accident, no guilt, no regret, no mistake, not death itself, because Easter really happened. And it's still happening. Because death really does lie face down, defeated, humiliated, beheaded. Maybe you're here this morning and you got dragged by your girlfriend or your boyfriend or your mom or your grandma. And you're just at the beginning stages of about thinking about God and church and faith. And you have a lot of questions and not a lot of information. I'd encourage you to make this decision today to say, God, I don't even know if you're there or not, but I'm going to make this a priority in my life. I realize this is the most serious question in the world, so I'm going to get a Bible, and I'm going to begin to engage people who are trying to follow you, and I'm going to seek answers for questions, and I'm going to take this really seriously. If that's where you are, I'd encourage you to make that decision today, and I would love to help you with that. Or maybe you're here today and you understand the story about Jesus and about his life and about his death on the cross and about how he was raised on the third day, but you have never clearly, personally responded to Jesus in your life. You've never really had that moment where you put your stake in the ground and you said, I am in with you. I'm not competent. I'm not very good, but I am in with you. The first Christians threw themselves in. They put the stake in the ground by going underwater and being raised themselves, going through that symbolic union with Jesus. What a great day to do that on Easter Sunday. Or maybe you're here today and there's a disappointment that is sitting heavy on your spirit. Maybe there's something that is filling your life right now with fear or worry or anxiety, and it's crippling you or has you down. I think what Jesus would say to you is this: I want you to give that to me because I am a third day God. I want you to give me your disappointment. I want you to give me your hopes. Give it to me. Understand that I know about pain and hardship and suffering and disappointment, but I know about hope too. And I will stand behind you. And with me, there will be hope. A surprising hope. Let's pray. God, would you speak hope into each one of our hearts, every heart here this morning? Because, God, we need hope in this world. Would you be one more time the third day God, the light that shines in darkness, and the life that is victorious over the grave? Thank you, and we glorify you, our God of the third day. In Jesus' name, amen.